Hey, listener, you probably have had a glass or two of Pinot Grigio, Prosecco, Chianti, Chianti Classico. But what about other wines of Italy? Do you know where to go from those well-known Italian wines? If you're ready to explore the wines of Italy beyond the usual suspects, then this episode is for you. You'll learn what to look for on those confusing labels and find Italian wines that will please your palate without draining your debit card. This is the Inside Wine Podcast. I'm Joe Janisch, a certified specialist of wine and wine industry professional since 1996, giving you insider tips to make the right wine decisions. Today, our guest is Wanda Mann. She has been a wine writer for at least 10 or 12 years. She is the founder and main writer for winewithwanda.com. She's also the East Coast editor at Somm Journal. And she's also, I believe, an expert on Italian wine, which is why we are having her on today. And Wanda, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Joe. It's such an honor and a pleasure. And, you know, calling me an expert, I always say I'm an enthusiast. I'm a champion of Italian wines. And one of the things I love is that there's always something to learn. It's just a country that's so rich in history and also just the really exciting new things happening in Italy.
Yes, I agree. And one of the reasons I feel like you're one of the Italian wine experts, at least in my circle, you've been to Italy so many times at this point, I think you should be like our ambassador to the country. How many times have you been to Italy?
You know, I've often had the same thought. So if anyone is listening that has that power to make me some type of ambassador. Well, you know, the funny thing is, I'm going to share something. I did not go to Italy for the first time until 2015.
Oh, wow.
And since then, I have been at least 20 times, if not more. And I was so, you know, passionate about Italian wines and meeting all of these Italian wine producers when they would come to New York. And I would always feel a little bit ashamed that I had never been to Italy. And it was a place that I'd always wanted to visit. So that year for my birthday present to myself was a trip to Italy. And I spent most of it in Rome. And then I also did travel to Tuscany. And that was my first time visiting a vineyard in Italy. And, you know, Italy has 20 different regions and I want to visit all 20. I think I'm up to about 13 now. So I'm more than halfway there, which is exciting.
Yeah, you have a pretty broad broad spectrum there of Italian wine, 13 of the 20. That's pretty good.
Yeah, it's pretty good. So I've been very blessed. You know, I always tell people, sometimes taking that first step and doing it on your own, it just seemed once I took that trip and invested in myself, then all of these opportunities started coming for me professionally to visit Italy. So it's been fantastic.
Yeah, and you've really been a great representative for Italian wine in general. And, you know, today, what I want to talk about is kind of exploring Italy a little bit. You've already explored Italy. You've explored 13 of their regions. And our listener is probably familiar with American wines and varietal-based wines, Cabernet, Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, Merlot. But then when it comes to Italy, they probably know Pinot Grigio. They probably know Chianti. They may have heard of the Big Bs, the Brunello, the Barolo, but maybe they don't know so much. And I would even argue that our listener might think that Chianti is a grape as opposed to a region.
Exactly.
So you know what? What I would really like you to do is kind of just, let's start with the easy one. The easy one is everyone has had a Chianti at some point in their lives.
Of course.
Right? So maybe we could start there and then you can help our listener explore beyond, you know, their familiar zone of drinking a Chianti and then where they can go from there to explore, you know, beautiful Italian wines.
Great. We always like to think of Chianti as the great kind of gateway.
Yeah, the gateway drug to Italy. Gateway wine. Whoops.
Gateway wine. Especially, I just remember even growing up in New York, and I imagine any city where you have a strong Italian-American community and you have a favorite Italian restaurant, I just remember always seeing what's called the fiasco, you know, that straw-covered bottle of Chianti. And I think it's probably the first Italian wine that many Americans tasted and felt comfortable with, even if we didn't know the grape. So the first thing I'm going to answer for you today, Chianti is not the name of the grape. It is the region in Tuscany, and the grape is Sangiovese.
And it's also probably the first wine bottle that we stuck a candle into.
Yes. And you know, my mom still has one. So
that's great. If you have not seen it, we'll have a picture in the show notes of a fiasco.
Oh, yes, we definitely should. So, yes. Yeah, so when we're talking about Chianti, we're talking about this large region in Tuscany where Sangiovese is grown and Chianti is produced. But also there's one of my friends described Chianti, think of Chianti as New York City. And then you have Chianti Classico, which would be Manhattan, as he described it.
That's a good way to put it.
And within Manhattan, you have different neighborhoods. So Chianti Classico, I believe right now is divided into, you know, it's always changing in Italy, as I'm sure you know. So the number of DOCs we discussed today could change tomorrow.
Yep, for sure.
The number of sub-appellations. But I believe there are 7 in Chianti Classico. And people go, well, why does that matter if it's all the same grape? One of the really exciting things about Chianti Classico and the Sangiovese grape is this concept of terroir, which sometimes can be hard to understand as a regular person. Like, what are we talking about? It's just wine. It's grapes. You ferment it. It's alcohol and you're done. But I think Sangiovese is a great way to understand how things like elevation, the exposure, the amount of rain, the type of soil. Sangiovese is very good at transmitting these nuances based on terroir. So I always encourage people, maybe start it with Chianti, which is fun and pleasant. It's usually enjoyable. You have those bright fruit flavors. When you get into Chianti Classico in the sub-regions, it's a great way to discover wines that may be a bit more complex. Depending on where it's grown, you might get some that are a little fuller bodied and more voluptuous, some that have even a little spice to them. I think Sangiovese is a grape that's really good at transmitting texture. And like every wine, often it's an interpretation of what the winemaker wants to craft. But I think what's really beautiful with Italian wines right now is that I'm not seeing a lot of over manipulation. People are really, you know, it's a cliche. We say winemaking starts in a vineyard. But I think in Italy, that is really true, that everyone wants to preserve the integrity and all that hard work putting to the vineyard. You know, I think Italy right now is leading the way in terms of organic vineyards, in terms of number of acres that are devoted to organic winemaking.
Yeah. And they've been doing that for years. They just have never done the paperwork to put it on the label, right?
Exactly. So even though what's a trend for us, I always say, has often been a tradition in Italy. So these are new ideas over here that maybe we're talking about, but it's really been a lifestyle. So I think, you know, this idea of putting the taste and the personality of the vineyard in the bottle with a little help from wine, because wine does need that human touch for it to actually be wine, right?
Right.
Wine doesn't make itself. It does need that human intervention. But I think more and more, Italy is really excelling at, we want to show not only our country, we want to show our region, and within that region, these sub-appellations, and we want to show this vineyard, and we want to show this section of the vineyard, and really just parsing it down so that you get something that's just very unique and a pleasure to drink. Because at the end of the day, we want it to taste good, right?
That's what we want at the end of the day.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned how the winemakers in Italy are holding to their traditions, and they're actually, they have rules they have to follow, especially when they put the word Chianti or the Chianti Classico on there.
Absolutely.
So there's at least a level of trust and a level of, would you call it consistency, when people are looking for wines with those words on the label?
I believe so, because you said, yes, you know, Italy has this, essentially these 3 tiers of wine, the DOC, DOCG, and your IGT wines. And as you said, all of those, they're not just letters on the label. They represent a set of rules that the winemakers must follow in terms of the percentage of the grape used. Sometimes that includes, you know, the minimum, maximum volume of alcohol in each bottle, because they understand that this wine is not just representing that winemaker, it's representing the region. And it's representing that appellation. So the rules are not there to confine the winemaker, but I think to ensure that everyone is striving for at least the same minimum level of excellence, which in Italy, that minimum level is quite high.
Yeah, right. Right. So for our listener, if they see the DOC on the label, like I think they already kind of get that it's something that is a good idea to look for. Like what's your feeling on the whole DOC/DOCG versus like just seeing, you know, Merlot on a label?
Yeah, that's a good point. I always tell people, you know, seeing DOC, and I guess I should remind people, DOC stands for, oh, don't make me speak Italian.
I'm not going to say it.
I was denomination. Say it, Joe. Denominazione origine controllata.
One more time.
Denominazione origine controllata, right? Wow. So denomination of controlled origin, I guess more or less is the loose translation. Right now, I think there are about 334 DOC wines, right, in Italy. So what that means, look, I always tell people, it's not a guarantee that you're going to like the wine because you're allowed to. That's very subjective in terms of taste. But it does give you a certain level of confidence that this wine meets the criteria established by that local consortium. So I think that's all. In DOCG, there are about 74. And that's where we're getting into, you know, we call it the top of the quality pyramid, right? The DOCG wines. So that's where we're talking about the Barolos and the Brunellos. Again, it's not a guarantee you're going to love the wine, but we're talking very strict criteria at that point. So again, I say it's kind of a seal of, okay, it met the standards at home.
Right.
And gives us a bit of confidence
right
here when we buy the bottle.
And it should give you some level of expectation of what's inside the bottle. Like if something says Brunello DOC, it's probably not going to taste like Barolo DOC or a Chianti DOC. Like each one of those DOCs kind of has their own character.
That's true. That is very true.
Now you mentioned Sangiovese.
Yes.
And that is the base grape. If Italians made wines in the United States, they would just take Chianti Classico off the label and they would just put Sangiovese on the label. But they put Chianti and Chianti Classico on it. And you mentioned that Sangiovese is grown elsewhere in Italy. So if our listener likes Chianti Classico, what are some other Sangiovese-based wines that they might enjoy, you know, based on like the styles and how, you know, Chianti Classico is made versus some of these other areas?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, if we're staying in Tuscany, definitely one that doesn't get nearly enough attention, I think, is Vino Nobile di Montepulciano, right?
One of my favorites, yeah.
So I think sometimes people are confused because they see Montepulciano on the label and they think, oh, this is Montepulciano. Well, Montepulciano di Abruzzo is a different grape from a different region. But when you see Vino Nobile di Montepulciano, that is from Tuscany and it's Sangiovese. And to me, it's kind of that great middle ground between Chianti Classico and a Brunello. Definitely can be a bit more complex than Chianti Classico, but maybe a bit more approachable than a Brunello. Again, great texture, great body, very elegant wines that age well. So I think anyone that has loved Chianti and then find themselves moving to Chianti Classico, try some Vino Nobile. I mean, really, people don't drink enough of it.
No, I agree with you. It's a beautiful wine. And I agree with you on the whole middle ground between, you know, it's like a stepping stone to moving into Brunello. So we had the gateway wine is Chianti Classico. The segue wine is Vino Nobile. And then when you're ready for the heavy hitter, what's the next step in Sangiovese?
Brunello di Montalcino. Where else do we go? You know, that's when you really feel like a grown-up, like I am drinking wine, right? There's just something so magical about Brunello. And for any of your listeners who may have gone there, Montalcino is tiny.
Yes. Yeah.
It's a really small hilltop, I guess, village in a sense, but it just has this aura surrounding it, you know, just the cobblestones and, you know, the stone buildings. And it's just such a beautiful place. And then you have all these beautiful hilltop vineyards. And many of these producers, you know, their families have been making wine for generations. And that's the great thing about Italy. You know, I think we have to remind ourselves, you know, Italy as a country, as a republic, that only happened in the 19th century. But winemaking has been consistent. And that winemaking history is 4,000 years old. So just the amount of time, you know, the stories these vineyards and these vines can tell. You know, there's a reason that Brunello is so coveted. People say, oh, what's the big deal? It's still Sangiovese. But again, we're talking about a singular expression. We're talking about different soils. You know, they have this mountain Amiata that kind of serves as a barrier in terms of helping to mitigate some of the weather conditions. And just these wines just age really well. So, you know, I think right now, and I should have double checked this, I think before Brunello can even be released, I think it was just the 2016s that we just tasted. So it's 5 years. It's 5 years.
Yeah, the winery is aging it for 5 years for you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Before we even get to taste it, before it's released. So it just goes to show you the artistry and how well you have to know this grape to even say, wow, I don't think this wine is going to be ready for at least 5 years before we're going to release it. And even then, you're talking about wines that can go 20, 25, 30, 40 years, maybe more.
Yeah, let's get into that just a little bit. Now, there are definitely exceptions with Chianti Classico and especially Chianti Classico Reserva. There are some wines that will benefit from some age, but generally speaking, a Chianti Classico and some Chianti Classico Reservas, you pretty much open them up, you drink them when you buy them, like you age them in the trunk on the way home. Vino Nobili, I mean, I guess some of them you can drink upon release. It really depends, but they also can benefit from aging, right?
Yeah. Yep, I think they benefit from aging. But I think more and more, I think you've hit on something really important. Most of us in the US, most people buy wine, they're drinking it that night or at least within that week.
Right.
And I think more winemakers are realizing the average drinker doesn't have this. I don't have a wine cellar at home. I live in a small Manhattan apartment.
Right.
So this idea of keeping a large supply of wines that I can't drink yet because they're not ready, well, that's a little aggravating. Most people, when they buy a wine, they want it to be ready to enjoy at that moment. So I think what's happening now is that there used to be this idea, well, oh, you just need to be patient. You know, you need to be more mature and just accept that you need to wait for this wine. Whereas now producers are like, we need to send wine that's ready to drink and for people to enjoy, but still has the capacity for aging. And for me, that's very exciting because I love tasting a wine when it's newly released because 9 out of 10 of them are drinkable. But with wines that have the capacity for aging, you get a hint also of how it's going to evolve. So when you're able to, if you can buy 2 or 3 bottles, and if it's a wine you really enjoy, tuck it away and you'll see how will the tannins change. Maybe it's a little ripe right now. Maybe some of that fruit's going to fall away and some more savory characters will come in, characteristics. So, but yeah, most people just, and winemakers, I think, want people to enjoy that bottle and say, wow, this is good now. Like, oh, it's not great. I guess I should have waited 10 years. That's not the experience that people want to have.
Now, let me ask you, because I do like to ask this every once in a while, especially with wines from Tuscany, when we're talking about some of these heavier hitters like the Vino Nobili or Brunello, do you decant them ahead of time to kind of aerate them, or do you just drink them right out of the bottle if they're younger?
I do not. I very, very rarely decant. The only time I would generally decant if I think there's a bottle with a lot of sediment.
Okay.
I'm a big believer, and I also am not a big fan of gadgets like, you know, oh, use this gadget to aerate the wine. It's kind of like a decanter type experience. I think part of the experience of drinking wine, especially older wines and complex wines, is how the last sip is different from the first, to see how a wine evolves in the glass. Does it open up more? Did it get tighter? Did it get flat? Did it bloom into something you didn't expect? So for me, I always tell people, you know, wine, yes, look, who hasn't had a hard day and said, I just don't want to think about it. I just want a glass of wine. We've all had that day.
Of course.
But in general, if you're talking about a wine that is something really special that you know, let it take you on a journey. And, you know, decanting, definitely there's a place for it. But in general, I don't even think I own a decanter, to be honest. Or it's tucked away somewhere.
No, I'm with you on how the wine evolves in the glass. It's something that, for whatever reason, I really have not experienced it as much with New World wines. other than, you know, of course, some exceptions, but it is something that with almost all of the, you know, the really Chianti Classico and up, I feel like it's something that happens with these Italian reds where there's really like an evolution in the glass that you talk about.
Absolutely. You know, I always, you know, remind people, I said, imagine that when we get up in the morning, we have to stretch, right? We have to move. It takes us a while to feel like ourselves. So you're a bottle of Brunello and you've been waiting for 5 years to make your debut. You have to give that wine time to stretch and flex its muscles and come alive. And, you know, there's a beginning, middle, not really an end, you know, because if it's a beautiful wine, you're just like, God, that bottle went by too quickly. But
get another one.
Get another one. But I think a wine shows itself in stages. And that's because there's really no other beverage that does that, yeah, right?
Right. Well, soda gets flat. But other
Well, soda gets flat. That is true.
So let's keep exploring a little bit, because I like what you're talking about here. So you mentioned Brunello being the, you know, probably the upper level of the Sangiovese. If our listener isn't ready to put down the dough for a Brunello, because most of them are at least $45, $50, $60,
$70. Yeah, yeah. It's an investment.
Where can they go? I mean, what about the Rosso di Montalcino? That's similar, right?
Absolutely. Some people like to call it the baby Brunello, right? I know that's a controversial term, but it is kind of the, I think it's 2 years bottle aging for the Rosso, right?
I believe
so. So it is a younger, fresher expression of Sangiovese coming from the same producers, maybe different, you know, plots of a vineyard, but Rosso is a great way to kind of get an idea of what a great Brunello is, you know? So I'm a fan of Rosso.
It's the same grapes from the same place as Brunello. They just, I guess it's just maybe not the absolute best grapes that they put in the Brunello, right?
Yeah. And often with Brunello, what you might see, for example, are, you know, single vineyard wines. I don't think I've ever seen a single vineyard Rosso. I'm not saying they don't exist. So, you know, Rosso is intended to be more accessible, to enjoy while it's young, to be more fruit forward. But, you know, I've never really liked this idea of a second label wine, you know. I don't see Rosso as a second label. I think it stands on its own as a very quality expression of Sangiovese, just different. And you can see the connection to Brunello. You can see the kinship that they're related in terms of overall style and respect for the grape. But they're fun to drink. I really enjoy them.
I do too. And I think maybe, you know, if again, if our listener's not ready to plunk down $70 for a bottle of Brunello, like it, maybe $25 for a Rosso, if you like that and you're like, wow, this is the type of thing I like, then go for the same producer that you got that Rosso from and invest in a bottle of Brunello or two or three.
I agree 100%.
So where else can we go with Sangiovese, or should we start looking at some white wines in Italy to explore?
About white wines.
Yeah, the white wine from Italy that everyone seems to know is Pinot Grigio.
Pinot Grigio.
Which is anywhere from, you know, $8 to $25 a bottle. Nobody really understands why there's so much range, but it's not the only wine from white wine from Italy.
Even though it seems that way in the US, right?
It does seem that way. But
every summer I am on a mission to get my friends to drink a white wine that isn't Pinot Grigio. Not that I dislike Pinot Grigio, because let's talk about Pinot Grigio for just a moment before we get into the other white wines.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, when Pinot Grigio kind of arrived in the US, I guess in the 70s, right? It was a big deal.
Yeah.
Unless you traveled to Italy, most Americans hadn't tried this wine before. And it kind of became this breakout superstar. And like anything, whether it's wine or fashion or a movie, if something becomes popular, then everyone wants to do it. So I think there's so much Pinot Grigio. The problem is that not all of it is high quality. And I always say Pinot Grigio is the wine that everyone has tasted, but no one knows what it's really supposed to taste like.
That's a good point. That's a very good point.
Because when you go to Italy, especially if you're talking about a region like Friuli in the Northeast, wow. You know, I've had so many Pinot Grigio to me that kind of taste like lemon water here in the U.S.
Yeah.
Like kind of just this light, you know, not much personality. It's just a refreshing white wine. But suddenly this idea of texture, aroma, body, minerality in a Pinot Grigio, it exists.
Yeah.
exists. And I'm starting to see a change. I mean, I always look at wine lists to see which Pinot Grigio they're carrying. And I'm starting to see some really interesting producers. And I would just encourage people, you know, everyone I think has a favorite Pinot Grigio, the one that they first tasted. And in their mind, that's what that wine is supposed to taste like. But I would encourage them to seek out, you know, especially from Friuli, which is often regarded as the premier region for white wines in Italy. It may blow your mind a little bit.
Yeah, you know, I wanted you to talk about exploring wines in Italy and beyond Pinot Grigio, but maybe the first step to exploring beyond Pinot Grigio is exploring to the Friuli for Pinot Grigio, because to your point, our listener may have never even had, you know, a really good quality Pinot Grigio from Friuli or the Collio, you know, further up north. So what they should do is look on the label for what?
Look for, I'm glad you said Collio, because Collio DOC is a great region, a great appellation for not only Pinot Grigio, but they have Ribolla Gialla, Friulano, all of these really interesting varietal wines. And you don't have to memorize them, but I would say in general, if you see Collio on a label, those white wines just tend to have a lot of texture. And I guess that's something in any wine for me, that's such an important trait to have, just this texture and some personality and structure. I always say these are wines that are elegant, but they're not wimpy. You know, they have finesse and style, but they're just very enjoyable. And I think once you've had them, it's kind of hard to go back to those kind of generic style, you know, Grigio wines, because they're really something great. And there's also Friuli Colli Orientali, you know, from the hills. Anything from the hills in Italy is great. Hills is always a good thing. Hills are always a good sign.
Yeah, I think to your point, start your exploration beyond Pinot Grigio with Pinot Grigio. Look for that more specific area, if it's Collio, if it's Friuli, if it's Graves, whatever it is. And expect to spend, how much more money do you think a Pinot Grigio of that level is going to be? Is that going to be like 17?
Well, this is the thing. I know for a fact there are some very popular brands. As you mentioned, you can find Pinot Grigio that's like $25 right here in the US. For around 20, you can get a really beautiful Pinot Grigio from Friuli, Collio. So you don't really have to spend that much more. You know, if you've been spending, you know, in a $15 range, then you expect maybe to spend $5 more per bottle. But it's $5, I think, that's very well spent, because it's just a very different tasting experience.
Yeah. And, you know, toward that, it's an easy way to start into your exploration of white wine, because if it turns out you like higher quality Pinot Grigio, then you know you can start looking into other areas. I like to tell my friends, you know, I try to say, look, try this other Pinot Grigio. And they're like, why would I spend $20 for a Pinot Grigio? Like, and then I say, well, how much money do you spend on a Chardonnay? And then all of a sudden they're like, well, sometimes it's $10, sometimes it's $35 or $40. It's the same deal, right? You need to explore a little bit beyond.
Absolutely. And it's true. Like we all always say, like everything in life, we all have our comfort wines.
Right.
I think if you're really excited about wine, you also don't want to fall into a wine trap or a wine bubble. You're not going to like everything you try, but it's always important to know what you don't like and why.
Yes.
The more wine you drink, hey, I was like, there's that wine muscle. You know, you have to train it. I might not make it to Crunch Fitness, right? But training my wine muscle is very important to me. Yeah. So I think it's a routine that we can all commit to, training the wine muscle. And that means, you know, trying different wines, trying different expressions of a wine you think you already, oh, I've already had that. I don't need to try another region or another style. Do it. Do it. And that kind of helps you. It just makes wine much more enjoyable. You know, such a cerebral activity as well, wine drinking, in addition to just being fun and delicious. And understand why you like some things more than others. You know, some people don't like, for example, a high acid white, right? So finally, oh, wow, I'm seeing a trend here. All of these wines that I'm really not responding to, maybe they're a little too acidic. I like maybe a lusher, rounder wine. And sometimes it takes a while to learn your own palate.
Yeah. And I feel like that's part of the fun of you know, drinking wine as opposed to just, you know, pounding vodka. Is like the, all exactly. these different wines are interesting in their own right. And it's like, it's kind of like an adventure of journeying through the wine world.
And I always tell people, even the wines, you know, as you and I being in the business, even the wines I don't fall in love with, I appreciate and I learn from.
Right.
Right. Because it is Good telling point. A story of that region, of that vineyard, of that producer. There's always something when someone has poured their heart and soul to making a wine, an authentic wine, you want to stop and give it the respect it deserves. And for me, that's an important part of the process.
Yeah, I like it's a good way to put it. All right. So we explore beyond Pinot Grigio with more expensive Pinot Grigio. Now, yes. If our listeners decided, all right, now I like that $22 Pinot Grigio. Now I want to explore more into the world of Italian white wine. Where's the next place to go, do you think? What's a good place to go?
Well, one that I really, really enjoy is Vermentino.
And oh, that's a good
Vermentino's
one.
Because we're seeing more of it, finally.
Yeah, finally. I agree.
Finally, right? I think it's having its breakthrough moment.
Yeah, it's happening.
It's happening. You know, it's refreshing, it's crisp. And the wonderful thing about Vermentino, you kind of have this Tuscan style from the Maremma coast.
Right.
And then you also have Vermentino from Sardinia. So again, it's always fun to kind of take the same grape and see how it expresses itself from these different regions. But Vermentino is just very approachable, fun. Sometimes it can be a little tropical. Sometimes it can be a little leaner. So I'm a big fan of Vermentino.
It almost sounds like you're talking about Sauvignon Blanc between New Zealand and France, the way you described Vermentino, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's a very good point. That's a very good point. Yeah. And I like both. I like from both regions, you know. Of course, Sardinia, you know, it's a little warmer there.
Okay, yeah.
So, you know, sometimes I get more of those maybe hints. And when I say tropical, I don't mean like this jammy, juicy fruit flavor. But maybe a little bit more of that, just a hint of tropical feeling that runs through the wines. And with the Maremma ones, I tend to get a little bit more of that mineral component. But I love them both equally, to be honest. I just think Vermentino, I don't think I've ever given Vermentino to someone and they didn't like it.
Yeah, no, I'm the same way. I love that wine. And to your point, you know, you just brought up a good point. Like there are very subtle things and hints and aromas that toward that. Although it might be a warm day and you want to drink that wine ice cold, you probably want to take it out of the fridge maybe a half hour beforehand, or you'll miss all of that fun.
So true. We definitely tend to drink, I always say, the white wine's too cold and the red wine's too warm.
Yep.
So yes, I've been amazed at how often you go to a wine bar and they just serve you this ice cold glass of wine.
Yeah, probably because it's hot out, but I don't know any other reason.
Because it's hot out. Yeah, but you do want to let that open up a little as well, you know, and you'd be surprised at the aromas and the taste. And again, a wine that's not meant to be necessarily complex, but still has these layers of flavor that is kind of fun to see those coming out the glass.
All right. So Vermentino is a good next step. What are some other places or areas or varietals that we should look at?
Yeah. But, you know, there's a lot of talk right now about volcanic wines, right?
Oh,
that's
yeah.
become a trendy thing. And
they're exploding.
They're exploding. But we're here all week, people. So, of course, we have Etna. Everyone is talking about Etna wines, right? In Sicily.
Yep.
And it's an active volcano. So this is like really exciting winemaking. And you have these really rich black mineral soils. And they're growing for the white grapes. You have Carricante and Catarato. Those are two that I can think of. And again, white wines with, and I know I use this word a lot, texture, personality, that mineral component. There's a there's a robustness to these wines, but they're not overwhelming. They're not heavy, but there's really something special, I think, about, I probably have had more Carricante than Catarato, but both really lovely white wines from Sicily. And then if we head to Campania, near Naples, right?
Yep.
when Naples is in Campania. No, we get it. They also have a volcano. I mean, it caused a bit of damage, as I recall.
Yeah, that was tough. Yep.
That was tough. And, you know, but it's interesting. I had a chance to visit Pompeii, and, you know, among the ruins that they found were kind of like a wine bar.
Interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So just to show you again how important wine culture has been in Italy, just for all these thousands of years. But you have these great white wines, Greco de Tufo, Falanghina. Help me out here. I know we know some more.
Fiano di Avellino.
Fiano, yes.
I like Falanghina, though, because I just like to say Falanghina.
Falanghina.
It's like a song.
It's true. And I always say, you know, it's a great way to kind of pretend you speak Italian is to learn the names of lots of Italian wines.
That's exactly what I do to trick my friends. I just start mentioning wines from Campania. I just say, Greco di Tufo, Falanghina, Fiano di Avellino. And they're like, wow, I didn't know you could speak Italian. I'm like, I just rattled off three white wines from the Campania region. Like,
it's so true.
It's all it takes.
Yeah. And not all of wines from there are volcanic, but a lot of them are. I just remember one of my best experiences being in Italy was like at some little, it was like a little fish market in a plaza where you kind of went in and you're like, I like that, and that, and they kind of cook it up for you. And they just bring out a simple glass of Fiano and it's like, oh, this is perfect. You know, this idea, you know, what grows together goes together.
Yes.
And it was like the most perfect meal with, you know, these local fish and seafood from the region with the local white wine. I don't even know who the producer was, but it was just a beautiful, local, well-made wine that was just satisfying on a hot day in Naples.
Yeah.
And it was from the region. So yeah, Campania, I think, is a really exciting region for white wines as well. And again, the great thing about Italy is you can find so much variety at a great price. You can spend $15 to $20 and walk away with something new and interesting that's really enjoyable.
Yeah. And, you know, you just hit on something that is so important and so intrinsic to Italian wine, which is the wines that you drink are from the same places where you get the food. You know, one of the reasons people love Pinot Grigio is because it's so friendly. It doesn't get in the way of anything. It has a nice acidity. You can drink it with just about any food, anything you want. But if you really want to start enjoying the other white wines of Italy, take a look at like some of the different cuisines from some of these different areas and the wines that pair with those cuisines. Can you give us like some examples from your travels, like of some pairings that really work in your mind that people might be able to replicate in the United States?
Sure. You know, so as I mentioned, and definitely in Naples, it was like, I remember having just like lightly fried seafood, right? That was great. Like in Sicily, I remember having white wine, very refreshing, with crudo, raw seafood.
Oh, sushi.
Yeah, so like Italian-style carpaccio, right?
Right.
This beautiful, thinly sliced fish. So yeah, you could also, you know, you don't have to stick with Italian food. You could also pair it with sushi, and it would be perfect. I remember in Friuli, in Collio, the food there is a little heavier and heartier, you know, it's right on the border of Slovenia. Okay. And pairing the white wines with foods that were a bit more, we had ham, for example. Mm. And it was amazing because the wine had this mineral component that worked really nicely with kind of the saltiness of the ham, and the acid kind of worked to help with the fat of the ham. And it was just a great combination. So the wines are more versatile than you realize. And so I think, you know, Asian foods go really well, whether it's Japanese, Thai food. I think a lot of times when we talk about foods that are great match with Riesling, a lot of the Italian whites work as well.
There you go. Yeah, it's a good point. People don't really talk about white wines from Italy as much as they talk about the reds for whatever reason.
It's true. And I think part of it has been, you know, both the blessing and the curse of Pinot Grigio, you know, and now the other white varietals are trying to make their way here and become better known. But inevitably, once people taste them, they really enjoy them. But it's kind of hard, you know, Pinot Grigio kind of became the grand dame.
Yes, right.
Of the white wines from Italy.
Yeah. And I think part of it too is that at least in the United States, people have just gotten used to, it's like Chardonnay, right? It's just that oaky, big vanilla thing, even semi-sweet in some cases. And Italian wines, there are no white Italian wines that are like that. They're more subtle and more food friendly.
Absolutely. That's a really good point. And I guess, you know, kind of the new world, old world thing in general, right?
Right. Yeah, true.
That's kind of the divide. And then you get into Italian whites like Verdicchio, who are like in the Marche region.
Yeah. Beautiful wines.
That's a white that, you know, we talk about white wines that can age. That's a varietal wine that ages really well is Verdicchio. And again, so many different expressions. I've had some that were a little bit oak, some that were just stainless steel. But again, I think what you find across the board, there are so many grapes. I tried to do a count. It's hard to find an official figure. I think there's almost around 400 legally recognized Italian grape varieties, but some say the actual number could be 1,000 or more.
Yeah, I've heard upward of 1,500 from some people, people from Italy, and especially once you start talking about the different clones and everything
exactly.
else.
Exactly.
You know, we were talking about Sangiovese before. You know, what we didn't touch on because it doesn't matter all that much to our listener, but you know, Sangiovese is called Sangiovese. It's called Brunello. It's called Vino Nobili. It's called Morellino. It's called all these different things, and it's essentially the same grape, but I don't know how that works in the count and how many different Moscatos there are. Like, I don't know.
Oh, I know. And, you know, yes, true. I should have mentioned Morellino when we were in Tuscany. Another great expression of Sangiovese, wines from Montecuco. They're kind of, you know, Montalcino's neighbor. They have some really interesting wines. You will never get bored with Italy. I always say the great thing about Italy, it will delight you. It will challenge you. It will inspire you. There's just so much happening from the well-known to the obscure. There's never a dull moment. It's a never-ending education. So it's really hard to call yourself an expert on Italian wines because it's just a lifelong journey.
All right. So Wanda, we're exploring beyond Pinot Grigio with more expensive Pinot Grigio. We're going to Vermentino. We're exploring into Vermentino from Sardinia and Tuscany. We are going into the volcanic wines from Sicily and Campania. Verdicchio is another thing we threw in there. Where else from Italy can we explore? What varietals or what styles of wine can we, because we've touched on the reds and the whites. What else do we have?
Well, anyone who knows me knows I love my bubbly, my sparkling wine. And like everyone, I've had a lot of Prosecco.
Yeah, the sparkling version of Pinot Grigio.
Exactly. Again, Prosecco was kind of that breakout wine here in the U.S., right? And I just want people to remember that, you know, Prosecco is not just something to add peach juice to make your Bellini or orange juice for your mimosa, okay?
Right, yep. Yeah.
You know, there are varying levels of Prosecco quality. And I'll just say, it's worth it to spend a little more often and explore. You know, there are people making single vineyard Prosecco wines. We now have the new Prosecco Rosé being an official. They've always made sparkling rosé in the Prosecco region, but now there are some rules in place to actually be called a Prosecco wine rosé. So that's exciting. But I also want people to realize Prosecco is not the only sparkling wine that Italy makes. And they make two really exceptional traditional method wines. That would be wine that's made in the same style as champagne, where the second fermentation happens in the bottle. So we're talking about Trento DOC and Franciacorta. And I love these wines. And I always tell people they are not an imitation of champagne. It's the same technique, but it's a different wine.
So don't expect champagne when you open these bottles.
Exactly. Expect, again, of course, you're going to have the beautiful, lively bubbles made from Chardonnay primarily as well. But because of, let's take Trento DOC, you know, we're talking about the Dolomite Mountains. So we're talking again about these high elevation vineyards, that kind of alpine air influence. Just really, I've had, you know, some Trento DOCs that are 2 years old. I've had some that are 10 or 15, 20 years old. Just really beautiful, elegant wines. And with that, you know, that texture that you expect from wines that have spent time aging on the lees, right? So sometimes you get that brioche and that buttery taste that you might find in a champagne. But again, not an imitation of champagne, something quite different. But these wines stand on their own, you know? I know with my Italian friends, the times I've, you know, had to bring a bottle. If I bring a bottle of Trento DOC, everyone gets very excited. And same with Franciacorta, because they're known for, you know, these are very labor intensive wines to make, like any traditional method wine, right? Mm-hmm. They're not easy to make. They take a lot of patience. So Prosecco, which is lovely and a unique thing, the bubbles come through the Charmat method. It doesn't go through that second fermentation in the bottle. Not quite as labor intensive. Different expression. Prosecco tends to be lighter, a little fruitier, a little more approachable. Trento Talk is kind of a bit more sophisticated in some ways.
Okay. Now, Prosecco again, like now it's becoming so ubiquitous, it's hard to pin it down. If you're going to do Prosecco, I mean, people spend 10 or 12 bucks on a Prosecco these days, but there are better ones. Another word that I like to say, Valdobbiadene.
Valdobbiadene.
You look at for some of those and spend a little extra, maybe $18 to $25 for a good Prosecco if you want to explore beyond the less expensive Prosecco that you've been drinking. Now, what about these Franciacorta and Trento Docs? What price range are we looking at per bottle for those?
Well, that's the thing. And I think that's part of the challenge they've had here in the U.S. You know, so a non-vintage of Trento Doc or Franciacorta isn't much less expensive than a bottle of non-vintage champagne.
Ah,
okay. So that is part of the challenge, you know.
It's a tough decision, right?
If you're going to spend... decision, exactly. Yeah. People know champagne and they're familiar with it. So sometimes to take that gamble of same amount of money, but I already know what champagne is. And I know people go, ooh, when I bring it, you know, people, there's a bit of a learning curve with the higher end Italian sparkling. So yeah, I would say minimum from what I've seen, $35 to $40.
Okay.
The Trento Doc and Franciacorta.
Hey, you know what? I would argue that a non-vintage champagne in that price range is probably one of the more the volume producers. Maybe not, I mean, still anything that says champagne on it is going to be excellent quality, but it might be that a $35 or $40 Franciacorta or Trento Doc may actually be a higher quality than a similarly priced non-vintage. Is that a fair assumption or am I being unfair to champagne?
I think that's a very good way to describe it. I think you're right on with that. And I just think it's important to remember, you know, with every wine, we kind of cast this umbrella. We're talking about whether it's French wine, American wine, Italian wine. Under that umbrella, there are so many categories and nuances that to just call something Italian wine, that's just the beginning of the conversation.
Yeah. Right.
It really is. So if someone says, oh, I don't like Pinot Grigio. Well, maybe you didn't like that one, but let me tell you, there's a whole world of wines out there in Italy and in each different region that I would find it hard to believe that someone doesn't have an Italian wine that they don't care for. That would just really surprise me. And I wouldn't want to be friends with them.
I can't be friends with someone who can't find an Italian wine.
Exactly.
Like. Well, you know what? Toward that, I think we should finish on what I find to be perhaps the friendliest of all of the Italian wines, as long as we were talking about bubbles.
Okay. I think I know what you're going to say, but go ahead.
Lambrusco.
Lambrusco. I agree. I love Lambrusco. And there's always like that mind moment. People go, wait, it's bubbly, but it's red.
Yeah. Yeah. Dark red, right? In many
dark
cases.
Red. It's not rosé.
Yeah, like almost black. It's so dark. It's like a navy purple, if there's such a thing. It's like,
yeah,
so dark.
Oh, and especially this time of year, my God, Lambrusco, so refreshing, so beautiful. And again, I think a wine that in the U.S. is starting to get the respect it deserves because we have some really high quality wines in the marketplace now. So I think a lot of people, you know, they may have tasted Lambrusco years ago and they just think it's kind of this really sweet and kind of jammy wine with a little bit of fizz. And that's just not that's not the real Lambrusco story.
Yeah. And again, I think you follow the price points, find something that says Lambrusco on it, that has the DOC on there, at least 15 to 20 bucks. Is that about right?
Yeah.
And you really can't go wrong. It's just the only trick is that it's going to be a lot drier than you expected. Although there are some types that are a little sweeter or not as dry.
And talk about the versatility with food. I mean, you look at where Lambrusco comes from, right? So we're talking about the land of Parmesan Reggiano, you know, balsamic vinegar.
Yeah.
One of my favorite, I'll be New York and say cold cuts.
Cold cuts,
I love mortadella, right?
Ah, that's what I was thinking.
Me, a glass of Lambrusco and mortadella, I am in heaven.
Yes.
Love it. Bolognese. You know, bolognese sauce. Oh, God, I'm getting hungry. So if you want to talk about a wine that just goes with so many different Italian foods that we all know and love.
Yeah, it goes with pizza, everything.
Pizza!
It goes with everything. And actually,
it goes with everything.
One of the most magical wine and food matches I have ever enjoyed in my life, and I try to repeat it as often as I can, is real legit barbecue. Not like you throw something on your grill, but like actual, like, you know, smoked ribs or pork, you know, pulled pork, that type of thing. Real barbecue with Lambrusco. It's just unbelievable, the match. It's so delicious.
Ooh, that sounds good. Yeah. Yeah. Now I really want a glass of Lambrusco. But I agree with you. It's one of those, you know, people need to, show some love to Lambrusco. It's just such, I've had some really amazing ones the past few years. And I'm like, wow, why aren't more people drinking this?
Yeah.
And, you know, part of it is there's so many beautiful, I think what we've barely tapped the surface, right? But from whether you're talking about classic reds like Chianti Classico and Brunello, talking about a well-known white like Pinot Grigio, whether we're talking about a lesser-known white like Vermentino, we talked about Prosecco, Franciacorta, Trenta d'Oc Lambrusco, pretty much any category of wine, Italy has a solid representation of it. And that's pretty impressive. And it's not a trend, it's a tradition, right? It's something they've been doing for a long time. And that's what makes it really exciting.
It's the one thing inside of Italy that's been consistent.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's a really good point.
If nothing else.
If nothing else.
Well, Wanda, I really appreciate you taking the time to do this and walk us through a virtual tour of Italy and of Italian wine. If our listener has not yet stepped into the world of Italian wine, I think you've opened the door and guided them in.
Thank you. Yes. Well, it's been a pleasure. And, you know, more than the facts and the figures, you know, for me, it's the emotion, right? And I think anyone who's traveled to Italy and has had a chance to visit a winery or just go to a restaurant, that feeling, that connection that wine brings. And I think that's one of the reasons in my wine writing, I kind of gravitated towards Italian wines, because even as I was learning, and there was a time when, like most people, I didn't know the difference between a Brunello and a Barolo. I found the Italian people so welcoming, so encouraging, just so happy to share their culture through wine. And for me, that's what makes it such a joy as well. Just this connector of people and cultures.
Agreed. But a big reason why I've been in the wine business as long as I've had.
Yeah.
So Wanda, you write about all types of wine, but you do have a pretty good focus on Italian wine. If people want to learn more about Italian wine, want to follow you, where should they find you on social media, on the interwebs? You know, where can they find you?
Sure. My website is winewithwanda.com. And on Instagram and Twitter, I'm Wine Dine Wanda, because someone stole the other name, but that's another story.
Next episode.
So Wine Dine Wanda on Instagram. And I tend to post there a few times a week what I'm drinking, and very often they're wines from Italy. So
great. We'll have those in the show notes as well. So when you stop your car or get off your bike or whatever it is you're doing, you can check the show notes, swipe up left, down, right. I'm not sure which. And that's about it. Thanks again, Wanda. Really appreciate this.
Oh, thank you. This has been fun. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for listening to my conversation with Wanda Mann. We hope you learned enough to explore beyond the Italian wines you know well and find some of the lesser known, great tasting, great values from Italy. Check the show notes for a cheat sheet on those gems, and also to find out how to connect with Wanda so you can continue your journey through Italy. I'll be back with another episode in about 2 weeks. In the meantime, to further your wine education and exploration, please visit wine365.com. And remember, Wine is food. It comes from a place. Enjoy it responsibly.